Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 22nd day of June 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And when it comes time to try to wrap up a week like this, when there are no shortage of contenders to kick things off, but somehow I think this story seems particularly apropos in a week like this. Call it good news and bad news, mostly bad news, and the good news wouldn't have even happened if it weren't for the really bad news. And it starts with the black robe priests of another god in Alaska, obviously ignorant of history as well as law. Their so-called Supreme Court, at the behest of the anti-American ACLU, having ruled that Satanists are now able to offer prayers, and you got to put that in great big quotes, before official Big Brother, a.k.a. government, meetings. Obviously, certain truths are no longer self-evident up there. And this one involves egregious error piled on top of egregious error. Because originally, the policy of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly stated that those delivering the invocation before their meetings must be members of a recognized church. But after their Supreme Court agreed with the anti-constitutional leftists united and ruled that policy unconstitutional, whatever the heck that means in an America where the Constitution no longer even gets read anymore, to the point where people think separation of church and state is somehow in there, along with Big Brother-approved theft and murder, but the right to keep and bear arms and be free of illegal search and seizure somehow isn't, well, this shouldn't surprise us, and neither should the consequences. So when a member of the Satanic Temple opened the latest government meeting in Soldotna, Alaska, by declaring, among other things, Hail Satan, over a dozen officials, here's all of the good news, got up and walked out. And what are several of the other egregious errors that helped to make all of this possible? Well, the Obama regime instituted the policy of granting expedited tax-exempt 501c3 status to various satanic groups. Christina Layla's story at the Gateway Pundit points out that while Tea Party and various Christian groups waited years to receive their similar acknowledgement by the almighty state of being tax-exempt, some of Satan's minions got it within 10 days, perhaps demonstrating that I Revere Satan is what that evil acronym really stood for all along. Which leads me, of course, folks, to the root fallacy that this entire story utterly overlooks, and that's in addition to the fact that the once self-evident truth was the purpose of government is to secure rights that come from God, the real one, not the fakes. And when the founders wrote, Congress shall make no law, right there in the First Amendment, having to do with your exercise of faith, the point was that they recognized that this government has no jurisdiction whatsoever over a church whose creator is Almighty God. No, not the state. Period. And listen carefully. That means your rights, sure as hell, don't come from Satan or his big brother. The other big news Thursday night into Friday, actually just before dawn Friday morning, further east, like say in the vicinity of Iran, was another attempt to kick off World War III via a military strike on Iran in response to that drone downing that, as it turns out, didn't happen. President Trump, say the stories, reportedly gave the order to attack Iran, or caved into it anyway, Thursday night over the downing of that unmanned drone that the U.S. claims was in international waters. And they went so far as to maneuver planes and ships into position before the strike was ultimately called off. For a while, no one knew why, even though there was speculation about something Trump said during a press conference with the Canadian Führer Trudeau, that it was just possible some kind of a rogue general had authorized the drone takedown, and perhaps the whole incident could have been some kind of mistake. The president himself, however, in what's been called an extreme show of transparency, actually tweeted at some length about why he decided against the airstrikes on Iran. Beginning by noting that Obama had made a desperate and terrible deal with Iran, giving them $150 billion plus a whole bunch of other emoluments in cash, as well as a free path to nuclear weapons and soon, and instead of saying thank you, he said, Iran yelled, death to America. Trump then terminated the deal, which he noted wasn't even ratified by Congress, and imposed strong sanctions. On Monday, they shot down an unmanned drone flying over international waters, and he said, quote, we were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites when I asked how many people will die. The answer from a general he noted was 150. And so 10 minutes before the strike, said the president, I stopped it, because he referred to the killing of 150 people in response to the shootdown of an unmanned drone as disproportionate. Hear, hear. And you know what, folks? After some consideration, the thing that really struck me as most unusual about all of this was that when the president actually ordered a stand down of the Pompeo-Bolton neocon axis to kick off World War III, the military actually listened to the commander-in-chief. Who'd have thought it? So now, if they'd only realized that the real invasion that actually matters, and indeed the whole point of a Department of Defense, is the invasion coming up from the south. All of which means that for the time being, about the best you can say is that the wars, plural, are temporarily on hold. And let's remember that when it comes to bad stuff being imported en masse across the southern border, it's not just the potential of WMDs or even MS-13 gang member WMDs, but other kinds of deadly diseases, too, that are of concern. We've had dengue fever, drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis, and even strains of measles that may not really even be measles at all, and lots of other new and wonderful diseases to boot. So we have to ask, why, says a piece by Ethan Huff at Natural News, is the U.S. government importing and then quickly redistributing all over the country thousands of migrants from Ebola-stricken nations? He points to InfoWars' Owen Schroyer, who recently attempted to get some answers about all that, only to be forcibly removed from the makeshift processing center of so many of the migrants in San Antonio, Texas, where they're being first dropped off and then loaded into vans for shipment elsewhere all over the U.S. You know what, folks? Almost like you can see the deep state waving its finger at Trump and saying, ha ha, how are you going to find him and deport him now? But not to worry, say the welcome wagons at the disease importation centers. Because Ebola has a 21-day incubation period, and these migrants, according to their own testimony, have been walking for more than 21 days, so they couldn't possibly have Ebola. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. Which inspired Mike Adams, the much-banned head honcho at Natural News, to chime in with some very unwelcome truth on the issue, saying that either these San Antonio officials are grossly incompetent or they're outright lying. Oh, and by the way, it begs the question of how many migrants from Africa actually walked to the U.S.-Mexico border, unless they can walk on water. Because, for one, the Ebola incubation period only averages 21 days, but it can be over 40 days in some people, according to data from the World Health Organization. And furthermore, who says the carriers entering the United States had to be the ones initially infected? They could have been infected by other carriers who perished before getting here, or didn't come. And infected migrants could end up entering the U.S., for example, on day 10 of their own incubation period, or maybe day 30. But by the time they begin to explode with symptoms, they've already been transported to who knows where, any of the dozens of U.S. cities currently receiving the time bombs. And surely, he notes, doctors had better know that magically declaring zero risk among people who come from a region of the world that's known for producing symptomless carriers of Ebola isn't at all a valid conclusion. So they're putting all of America at risk for political purposes. Or worse. And when it comes to war, most of us recognize that the real issues are generally economic anyway, and this current environment is no exception. So let's turn next to the meltdown, still in progress, starting midweek with the Fed's FOMC meeting, before which, on Wednesday, pretty much everything economic was on hold, waiting to see what the masters of the universe would decide, or, as it turns out, well, delay deciding to do. But they did telegraph what many were suggesting is probably an inevitable move anyway. Let's start there. Powell throws in the towel, says the headline from Zero Hedge. Gold, global stocks, and just about everything else have soared. The S&P is at all-time highs, as yields, of course, tumbled. Risk assets? Safe havens, it asks? Well, it doesn't matter. Just buy it all, as central banks enter the last stretch of the race to the bottom, and that would mean the credibility bottom as well. What they call the global dovish tsunami, still in its jawboning phase, was started by Mario Draghi on Tuesday at the ECB, and then escalated on Wednesday when Fed Chairman Powell finally threw in the towel and effectively said he would cut rates in July, which resulted in a global scramble for both risk assets, meaning things that still yield above the rate of real inflation, like some stocks, and safe havens, with global equity markets in a sea of green, and the S&P futures overnight too hit an all-time high. And as I began the recording today, that put most of the U.S. markets, S&P 500, Dow Jones, etc., up a little less than 1%. Dow, for example, was up over 200 points. 10-year Treasury yields, of course, plunged overnight, dropping below 2% for the first time since November of 2016 and reaching almost 1.97% before finally rebounding. And finally, they note, the ultimate safe haven assets, the real stuff, gold and silver, surged overnight. And gold finally broke out above multi-year support, as a lot of folks have been talking about breathlessly of late. Before the week was out, paper gold at least did manage to trade even above $1,400 for the first time in years. Silver breached $15 to the fiat ounce and got almost to the mid-15s. And says Zero Hedge, the rest of the world joined the party too, from the European Stock 600 Index, boosted by tech shares and car makers, to Asia. Oil prices, too, are up, along with gasoline futures, not only because of the maybe-on or maybe-not war, but because of a major explosion and fire in one of the biggest refineries on the U.S. East Coast, in Philadelphia Friday morning. But perhaps the biggest underreported economic news has to do with the coming fiat climax, if you want to call it that. Says the Zero Hedge summary, the deflationary ice age predicted 25 years ago or so by Society General's Albert Edwards is now upon us. And as a result, drum roll please, global debt with a negative yield has soared by $700 billion in one day following the latest FOMC, well, almost a move. To a record $13 trillion total. The 1-2 punch, they say, of a dovish Draghi and Powell unleashing the deflationary spirits has resulted not only in the S&P 500 hitting a new all-time high, but an unprecedented flight to safety. Things like gold and silver, as investors freak out that a recession may be imminent, judging by the fearful and forceful jawboning of central bankers hinting about more and more imminent easing. And yes, gold has hit above $1,400, its highest price since 2013, and global yields have reached new all-time lows. So, the notional amount of global debt trading with negative yield soared by an amazing $700 billion in just one day late in the week, adding a whopping total of $1.2 trillion overall this week, and that's the biggest weekly increase in at least 3 years, pushing the total of negative yielding debt worldwide to another new all-time high of $13 trillion. Europe in particular, they note, for lack of a better word, is a disaster. And funny, isn't it, how all those folks that have opined for years about how precious metals like gold and silver don't pay any interest, which really isn't true anyway, but even so, a whopping 0% of something that maintains its value beats the living you-know-what out of a guaranteed loss that negative yield provides. Which leads me to this piece. The headline will almost suffice, from Michael Every at Rabobank, who says, and I like this quote, we're on the verge of a lunatic monetary policy and lunatic fiscal policy combined. He cites up front the Bloomberg headline, too, that says it all for current markets. All-time highs in everything American, because it looks less bad than much of the rest of the world, as the risk rally crescendos. So yeah, as real Austrian economists have pointed out for years, a collapse in yields is not bullish, nor is it indicative of a new golden age for the global economy. Quite the contrary, as Zero Hedge summarizes it, it signifies that debt investors are more confident than ever, that the global growth rate is collapsing, and that only central bank intervention could possibly delay, but not really prevent, the world sliding into recession, or worse. So maybe it's no wonder that World War III futures are really hot right now. Next, we come to a story that I knew I was going to have to do eventually, especially when we recap a week like this, and it fits nicely here, even though a whole lot of it is basically fake news, or worse. In no small measure because it comes from none other than the New York Times. Their headline says, U.S. escalates online attacks on Russia's power grid. And it quotes so-called current and former government officials to say that the United States is stepping up its ongoing digital incursions into Russia's electric power grid as a warning to President Vladimir Putin and a demonstration of how the Trump administration, sick, is using new authorities to deploy cyber tools more aggressively. Here comes a bit of what I generally refer to as the 80-20 rule, folks. A little truth, or maybe sometimes more than a little, but mixed with a lot of falsehood as well, in a ratio of 80%, 20%, and decide yourself which one is which. In interviews, it says over the past 3 months, officials described the previously unreported deployment of American computer code into Russia's grid and other targets as a classified companion to more publicly discussed action directed at Moscow's, did you catch that? Moscow's disinformation and hacking units around the 2018 midterm elections. Of greater concern to those of us that have been paying attention is the other hacking done by the likes of Gulag to Facebook and, of course, direct voter fraud and software manipulation of the easily manipulated, or so it seems, electronic voting machines that sadly allow all kinds of really disreputable stuff to happen and outright theft of elections, witness more than a few during the 2018 midterms. And the fact that the socialist media giants don't call it hacking, they have other terms like shadow banning, search algorithm tweaking, you know, to display only the results that they want you to see in the order and intensity that they want you to see them, does not mean that they're not hacking elections far more effectively and certainly covertly than Russia even tried to. So back to the propaganda and the 80-20 rule. Advocates of a more aggressive strategy now say it was long overdue after years of public warnings from the Department of Octoon Homeland Security and the FBI. Certainly not about the election rigging they've been getting away with, but the fact that Russia has inserted malware that could sabotage American power plants, oil and gas pipelines, or water supplies in any future conflict with the United States. And here's the part that they really don't want to talk about, folks. In some cases, have no doubt that they were using backdoors put in there by those very same agencies and others, or at least at their behest with their public-private partners. You deliberately make the systems vulnerable, and all kinds of disreputable criminals, including the ones that ordered it, can then get in. Yes, they say, and this is for sure true, power grids have been a low-intensity battleground for years. Now, what's interesting in the piece, and what's attracted the attention, is the fact that two administration officials said they believed Mr. Trump, hey, who is he anyway, had not been briefed in any detail about the steps to place the implants, the software code, inside the Russian power grid. Pentagon and intelligence officials describe broad hesitation to go into detail with the man who thinks he's president and commander-in-chief about operations against Russia because they were concerned about his reaction. Are you ready for this? The possibility that he might countermand it or say, for crying out loud, quit doing that, or even discuss it with foreign officials, as they say he did back in 2017 when he mentioned a sensitive operation in Syria to the Russian foreign minister. Well, you know, the president's problem is he was elected to try to avoid things like World War III. And maybe this shouldn't come as any surprise. Shortly thereafter, the president lashed out at the New York Times, saying they'd engaged in a, quote, virtual act of treason for that story that said the U.S. was ramping up its cyber intrusions into Russia's power grid. Which, if you think about it, folks, is true whether the story itself is true or not, because at the very least, it undermines national security and presidential authority. Perhaps because of comments like this one, this comes as the U.S. looks for new ways to punish Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election and prevent a recurrence. And yeah, we know what that means. The Gray Lady, in its official public relations account, called the presidential accusation dangerous and said it had told officials about the story before it was published, just not the president, and no security issues were raised. In a pair of tweets sent out over the weekend, President Trump asserted the story wasn't true and denounced the reporters as cowards, saying, quote, do you believe that the failing New York Times just did a story stating that the United States is substantially increasing cyber attacks on Russia? This is a virtual act of treason by a once great paper, so desperate for a story, any story, even if bad for our country, he wrote. And he followed that up by saying that not only were some other things they said lies, but they're, quote, true cowards and without doubt the enemy of the people.
And from there, I move on to another piece, Ponder the Irony, from, of all places, the left-leaning Bloomberg, which is finally admitting in an op-ed by David Fickling that, quote, cyber attacks make smart grids look pretty dumb, which is something your electronic engineer host has been saying for a long, long time. But at least some of the left is finally figuring it out. Maybe now that the back doors are such a vulnerability that they can no longer be ignored. Oh, and also the fact that for the most part it's probably too late to do much about it. Here's how Fickling kicks it off. Imagine if your thermostat led to a region-wide power blackout. It's a scenario, they say, that's looking increasingly plausible, some would say even probable. Argentina isn't ruling out a cyber attack as the possible cause for the mass outage there that affected millions of people in 5 South American countries over the weekend. And even if that incident turns out to have a more innocent explanation, and don't count on it, folks, at least don't count on believing whatever it is you're told. The U.S. government is stepping up digital incursions into Russia's power grid, yes, as none other than the reliable New York Times reported over the weekend, citing unnamed officials. And the growing threat, they say, from hacking is somewhat inevitable, given the way our power systems are changing. Yes, the power grids have generally been highly centralized, but the spread of smart metering and automated control systems has now changed even that landscape, with more than 10% of global grid investments, some $30 billion a year or so, now dedicated to digital network infrastructure. And the grids of the near future are likely to be increasingly decentralized, and that's a probable misnomer, folks. Not only an oversimplification, but certainly approaching a technical falsehood anyway. Because while the idea of the things they mention here, like domestic refrigerators, air conditioners, and industrial facilities that are compensated for switching off their power during demand peaks, while other things like vehicle chargers soak up the excess when it's available, to call those decentralized is a gross oversimplification. Do they get software updates from a central source? Can they be given orders from the power grid? Or can they ultimately just be hacked or otherwise centrally controlled? You betcha. And the problem here, says Fickling, is the vast amount of infrastructure, think 5G folks, and there's more to it than that, needed to support such a setup. Any smart electrical grid, Bloomberg admits, needs a parallel telecommunications network to work and collect and harness the volumes of data that it'll generate, and that makes every connected thermostat or smart refrigerator or you name it, down to your TV, baby monitor, and toaster oven, a potential entry point for cyber intruders. And the sleep-depriving smart meters that they're foisting on a gullible public may be the worst culprits of all. About 588 million of the blankety-blankin' things, that's your host term there, will be installed worldwide by 2022, according to a report last year by Global Data UK Limited Consultants. And once you include other connected devices and even grid operators' own control systems, that's still only the tip of the iceberg. Why, Stuxnet, that worm that crippled Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities back in 2010, appears to have been spread initially via an infected USB drive smuggled into one of the plants and plugged into a computer. Faced with an ever-growing and diversifying list of weak spots, industrial companies, says the piece, are only slowly waking up to the scale of the risk. And here, folks, I'll skip over some of the happy talk because, quite frankly, I don't buy it. But in spite of all of that, the piece admits, it still might not be enough. For one thing, they say, malicious hacks of electrical grids are far more likely to emerge from sophisticated state actors. Yeah, think three-letter agencies, who are better at covering their tracks and even blaming other state actors for those attacks and then lying low for years after they launch one. And for another, he correctly concludes, the cost of leaving a door open, especially a back door, folks, could be far greater. A hack of an internet company or credit card database might compromise personal information, but as the 2015 attack on the Ukrainian power grid demonstrated, electrical network inclusions could leave hundreds of thousands or far more folks without power for hours or for far longer. Our lives, he says, are dependent on such utility systems operating in the background, cleanly and without incident. But the latest reminder from South America is an indication of our vulnerability in a far more uncertain world. And he doesn't say it, but your host needs to, again. and it's a word to the wise as well. And that takes us to the break.
There's going to be the devil to pay. All you sinners, don't you know that you ought to know? Satan's waiting for you deep in the down below. Below, you can go to that church on Sunday. You can wash all your sins away. But if you're only really good on one day, it's going to be the devil to pay. Oh, live it up, laugh it up, judgment's coming. It's going to be the devil to pay.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is still Mark Call, and perhaps the appropriate way to kick this one off is with the continued destruction of the rule of law and its increasingly obvious replacement. Whether you call it a narco-terror state, like Mexico, or a public-private partnership run by deep state mafia. So here goes. Arkansided or MS-13 assassinations? Hey, you decide. Six related Pizzagate deaths, as a piece from Dave Hodges at The Common Sense Show and Alexandra Daily, in just 72 hours. It's been long established, they begin, that cartel activity, consisting largely of their favorite big three activities, drug trafficking, child sex trafficking, and gun running, are now a hybrid model of the marriage between Middle Eastern terror groups and the South and Central American drug cartels that have long employed the violent Central American street gangs to carry out their political, media, and law enforcement assassinations. In Mexico, over the last campaign cycle, 400-plus politicians were murdered, an untold number of law enforcement officials have been assassinated, along with many of their family members, and journalists, too, killed at record rates in Mexico. And now with the importation of fully intact family-style cartels right into America, it's only a matter of time until the same behaviors. Well, wait a minute. Who's he kidding? They've been going on for a while. Here they're just a little bit more hidden because if the journalists are threatened enough, they decide not to report on them. Anyway, one way or another, surface inside the United States. And yeah, Hodges goes on to say, some believe that MS-13 has already reared its ugly head and are probably very active in the political assassination game anyway. I mean, really, folks, just look at Southern California. Hodges says, when asked recently why MS-13 was being imported in such big numbers into the United States, he replied, quote, when political assassinations are planned, along with media figures and law enforcement officers, the brutal use of MS-13 can lead to a complete destabilization of our society, while keeping the CIA and Clinton Foundation hands clean in this arena. And that's a pretty good way to put it. It also, no doubt, goes a long way to explaining why you haven't seen orange jumpsuits on a whole bunch of scumbags and traitors. He notes that Alexander Daly sent him a list of 10 documented murders, alleged murder-suicides, and outright murders that seem to jump out and demonstrate the levels of criminality that the cartel terrorists are deep involved in already on this side of the border. They could have been Arkansided as well, he notes, and maybe it's some of the same people involved in both, because one way or another, each of these deaths, he says, is related to Hitlery. And of course, if you don't remember, the term Arkansided is reserved for the long list of people who posed a legal threat to the Dixie Mafia, a.k.a. the Clintons, and their organized crime activities and their continuation. Of the 10 who've been recently murdered, 6 of them were directly related to child sex trafficking, related Clinton emails to that effect, and specifically to comet Pizzagate, and all of them have died mysteriously within just a 72-hour period. As he puts it, can anyone else say the purge? So, without further ado, on to the list. Number 1, Linda Collins Smith, former Arkansas State Senator who died of gunshot wounds and in a bizarre manner with her body wrapped in a blanket, which some suggest is symbolic of, you got it, a cover-up. Jonathan Nicole was a former Oklahoma state senator, as was Colin Smith, who also died of a gunshot wound, and in what's called message-killing fashion, the gun was found on a table near the body. Stephen Silks, now deceased New York deputy, allegedly committed suicide by gunshot, but he was only a month away from retirement, which does kind of raise eyebrows. He was also one of the few people who's actually seen the horrifying and graphic details on the infamous Anthony Weiner laptop. Weiner's own version of an insurance policy that literally, supposedly, made grown men cry. And these may, suggests Hodges, be some of the same emails that might have gotten Seth Rich murdered. There are 33,000 of them, of course, in the Clinton Library. Well, not really in the Clinton Library, but should have been. That various deep state and Obama-appointed judges have worked so hard to cover up as they block their release to the public. What are we up to? Number four, Joseph Calabrese, NYPD homicide detective, committed arsonicide with his own gun, and he was yet another who'd seen the infamous Pizzagate-related info on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Herb Sandler, another Pizzagater tied to the infamous Comet Pizzagate and the Podesta emails that have been kept out of the public eye. You know what, folks? I have to pause here and say, for those that are superstitious, you're probably far better off seeing what was inside Pharaoh's tomb and suffering the curse of the Pharaohs than the curse of the Clintons. And then finally, perhaps most notable member of the tragic list, Tony Rodham himself, brother of none other than Hitlery, and in a very bizarre twist of fate, the cause of his death is simply not being released. At least with Scalia, they admitted he was suicided by pillow, and then failed to do an autopsy. Says Hodges, I can't remember a higher profile death when the cause of death wasn't at least vaguely referred to. And he says it again, look, we cannot conclude that these six individuals within just a three-day period were taken out by Clinton death squads, because now that we have MS-13 in the country, there's clearly at least one more level of plausible deniability baked into the cake. And if history is any guide, as the Mexicanization of America continues, we're likely to see a lot more of these. Let's call this next story a quick cautionary note. Both at home and abroad, courtesy of BreakingDefense.com and Zero Hedge, the U.S. Army is going to deploy soldiers, well, first at least to Afghanistan, with a brand new handheld drone they claim is going to have all kinds of wonderful features. The 1.16-ounce Black Hornet, developed by Prox Dynamics of Norway and acquired by U.S.-based FLIR Systems, is designed for local surveillance missions over the modern battlefield, and it looks like it could be used for, let's just say, other things as well. The tiny drone has high-tech sensors, allowing it to operate day or night. They claim it has low audio and visual signatures, so call it semi-stealth, a flight time of about 25 minutes. It's basically palm-sized and features its own promotional video. And if history is any guide, since you're hearing about it now, it probably means they've got better stuff already coming to a theater near you. Here is one quick dichotomy that I can't let the week go by without at least reporting on. Comes from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit. A 30-year-old who stole a gay flag from a church, can you believe that, in Ames, Iowa, and then set it on fire in front of a gay bar, has been charged with the commission of a hate crime. But meanwhile, in Cleveland, a well-known protester burned a different flag, and the city is paying him a $225,000 reward as a result of his arrest. The difference? It was a U.S. flag at the Republican National Convention in 2016. And you know there's a message there somewhere. All right, well, after all of that, what is the other big, at least so far as the talking heads are concerned, economic news of the week? The Waste Stream doesn't want to talk about meltdowns anyway, so for a whole lot of reasons that'll soon be obvious, they're going to want to push this instead. Especially because of where it comes from. Big Brother, Big Tech, and the public-private partnership that wants to control not only all of your online interactions, but, well, all of your interactions, including financial, period. To Facebook, which has introduced their much-anticipated Libra digital currency with a landmark white paper that's been long anticipated and came out today. Yes, as Zero Hedge's summary, after weeks of anticipation, the day has finally arrived, and in a dramatic push into uncharted waters for the socialist media behemoth that saw Mark Zuckerberg make overtures to his former arch-nemesis, there comes a time for the cabal to pull together. Facebook has finally published the white paper for its long-awaited stablecoin called Libra. No, they say it wouldn't be an exaggeration to claim that the white paper was the most hotly anticipated crypto white paper ever, made even more so by Facebook's extreme secrecy surrounding the project, which Zuck reportedly hopes will steer the company out of the morass of scandal and into the new and ever more profitable field of making money out of nothing. But it's important to note, Facebook will also be expanding into a major new business, payments. Just as the FTC and DOJ initiate various antitrust investigations against two Facebook and a handful of other Big Brother, Big Tech, cabal partner tech giants, and regulators on both sides of the Atlantic have already expressed, I hope you're sitting down for this one, folks, some concern. And here, folks, is where you have to pull up and really batten down the hatches on that suspension of disbelief thing. Per the white paper, Facebook's global stablecoin is called Libra, and it will operate on its own Libra blockchain, backed by a reserve of assets, probably meaning your data. But I'm getting cynical here, aren't I? Which technically makes it a stablecoin, kind of like something called Tether. And the coin will be governed by a non-profit consortium.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
The Libra Association, which evidently you can buy into if you're part of the club for only $10 million. And it will oversee the development of the Libra ecosystem from Switzerland. And per the FT, Facebook will spin off a unit called Calibra, which they say will be totally separate from Two Facebook, in order to manage the Libra digital wallet offering, which will then be integrated into Two Facebook's family of apps. And if you wonder what that means, just think, well, everything you're probably going to ever be allowed to access. Two Facebook said the financial data gathered by Calibra wouldn't be shared.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Without users' consent. No, of course not. But just remember, in order to participate in the global blockchain economy, you'll have to take the mark. Give your electronic consent now, won't you? Some 28 partners, including Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and a smattering of others, have all pledged to help build out the ecosystem, and they'll each kick in $10 million to start that Libra association that will govern the coin and its so-called reserve assets. And according to The Guardian, the coin will facilitate payments across Two Facebook's various platforms, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but you know there'll be more, as well as the new Libra Payments app. And it will be open source, according to Facebook, allowing developers to build out the ecosystem. And here even Zero Hedge waxes a bit cynical, suggesting it just might be incentivized with gifts of sensitive user data if you participate. And here I have to wax even a bit more cynical, folks, and suggest that if software developers find any problems in that open software system, they might find themselves banned from not only to Facebook, but all the infrastructure that they need to survive in the post-Libra world. And across the developed and developing worlds, Two Facebook hopes that its app will help plug what they call the payments gap, created by 1.7 billion adults who don't have bank accounts. Fox Business summarizes some of that this way. Two Facebook's new cryptocurrency platform could provide the embattled socialist media giant with a new stream of revenue of literally historic proportions, think Rothschild Empire, as it contends with a possible federal antitrust probe and continued scrutiny over its data privacy sick practices. And it'll be used for everything from person-to-person payments, traditional e-commerce, and spending on apps and gaming services on Facebook-owned properties. Here's how the white paper puts it, and I'll quote one line, and only one at this point, from the white paper itself. Libra's mission is to enable a simple, global, they don't put it in here, but I will, e-currency and financial infrastructure that empowers billions of people, unquote. And in the process, of course, allows us to monitor, influence, and yes, control all of them. And since it's true that they've already signed up Visa as one of their public-private partners, I guess it's fair to say they'll probably have a motto that sounds something like this. Libra, it's everywhere you'll ever be allowed to be. And given that they're already hell-bent on controlling your speech and even thought patterns, what could possibly go wrong? With that, I turn to a piece from Tom Luongo, also courtesy of Zero Hedge, about what he calls Facebook's crypto Trojan rabbit, explaining that in addition to the obvious goal of complete and total control, Libra is another attempt by the current banking establishment to slow the flow of hard money, meaning real gold and real silver, into the world economy. I'd put that a bit differently, folks, and say that as the acceleration out of collapsing fiat worldwide continues, this is an attempt to staunch the bleeding before it really gets started and say, hey, you don't actually want those old-fashioned things like gold and silver, do you? Wouldn't you rather have yet another wonderful new fake? But this one's high-tech. In this respect, he writes, Libra is no different than Ripple or other dollar-settled Bitcoin futures contracts. They're projects and products designed to slow the exodus out of the shadow banking system. Ripple is a way to lower foreign exchange fees, and off-chain futures settlement is a way to control Bitcoin prices and exacerbate volatility to slow crypto adoption by the, well, the rest of us, folks, the ones they call the normies. And here he notes that Caitlin Long of the Mises organization, in her excellent Forbes article, points out that Libra will get a whole bunch of major financial players backing it with the goal to become the standard creator in the vein of the Dow Jones Committee or the IMF, since they will determine the basket weighting of Libra itself. It won't, however, be a cryptocurrency, says Luongo, in the traditional sense. It won't have a limited supply, defined inflation rate, or any other commodity character whatsoever. And when it comes to the Bitcoin claim of proof of work, a.k.a. mining, pshaw! Every good Friedmanite knows that opportunity cost in creating new monetary units is simply wasted capital, and only open-mouth breathing rubes stuck in the 19th century think that's important. Instead, and here it comes, folks, Libra's supply will be regulated just like every other fiat currency. Yeah, whoever gets to print it decides how much to print. In other words, a central authority. Facebook already, he says, wants all your data, whether you're an account holder or not, and now, simply put, they want to control your currency as well. Call it the central bank of Facebook, Luongo does. And when you examine how they're marketing it, this is clearly, or at least he says it looks for all the world, like Facebook's application into the cartel of price-setting central banksters. At this point, he quotes Caitlin Long in her Forbes article, noting that she makes at least six important points about Libra and the fact that it could be a force for good. We'll come back to that in a second. Facebook's cryptocurrency, she writes, will be a powerful force for good in developing countries, which is where Facebook intends to market the product, well, at least first. Why? Well, because central banks in developing countries are notorious for their lack of discipline in maintaining the value of their fiat currencies, which too often lose purchasing power. See Zimbabwe, Venezuela, etc., etc. And yes, Luongo agrees, governments are terrible at managing the value of their fiat currencies for all the reasons Austrian economists, like the Mises Institute, have laid out in painstaking detail for decades. Which leads him to make one good point. I'll add one to it. The obvious conclusion? Facebook and the Wall Street banks, which actually control it, are creating a coin to do away with national currencies in the countries most vulnerable to the Fed's control over the global monetary system. It's the obvious next step in their quest to create a world currency. And if the current world fiat system is threatened by, oh, I don't know, says Luongo, maybe the implosion of a bunch of banks like Deutsche Bank, sparking a global sovereign debt crisis, then a so-called stable coin like Libra to replace the discredited dollar, euro, yen, pound makes some kind of perverse sense. And if the plan has always been, as Jim Rickards has been saying for years, that the response to a collapsing monetary system would be national currencies replaced by IMF SDRs as the reserves of a banking system, upon which foundation you build a trackable blockchain, like this new Libra, then having a cryptocurrency Trojan horse as a bait and switch has been part of the plan to maintain confidence in those very institutions that fomented the crisis in the first place. And what better platform to do that with than Orwell's Panopticon itself to Facebook? And it's here I interject my own observation when it comes to this idea of starting out really, really good. Zuckerberg, at least, knows how that should work. You offer something, perhaps even free, that really looks like a great value and provides some real utility. Let people talk with their friends. Get them suckered into it. Build a huge growth platform. And only then they begin to figure out, just like flies being trapped in honey, maybe there were some not-so-obvious strings attached all along.
and what at least at first glance looked like it was free was really a lot more expensive than you could have possibly ever believed. And this next point buttresses that argument as well. Said Luongo, as I pointed out before, Bitcoin was needed to replace all of the Ponzi schemes masquerading as money from the various fiat currencies of the world. Bitcoin was born out of the extreme fraud of the financial system, he writes, under Greenspan and Bernanke. They used leverage, ratcheted up post Y2K to levels which could only be supported through legislative fiat to wall off capital fleeing the system. And the response was a group of folks that applied the teachings of Austrian economics and Ludwig von Mises' regression theorem to create a digital asset which became more resistant to fraud the more it was adopted. The result was Bitcoin. It was, as he put it, a catastrophic mutation, a thing born out of necessity to free human beings from a central issuing authority of new monetary units. That relationship needs to be broken, he said then, if we're going to free ourselves from the cycle of tyranny of the few at the expense of the many. In other words, government ineptitude and or fundamental evil created Bitcoin, which was Ms. Long's point in a recent Mises Weekend talk entitled, Will Blockchain Free Us from Wall Street?, which focused on the domestic reasons why the dollar is yet to collapse and why Bitcoin provides a framework in which we could craft money that isn't controlled by a central issuing authority. An end, as he put it, to the counterfeiting of kings we've experienced in the past, which is where the battle lines are being drawn with Libra. Facebook and Wall Street, he says, are banking on two Facebook's pervasiveness to drive mass adoption and build an adjunct to the existing financial system which slows the growth of the real cryptocurrency marketplace. The trouble is, he says, they value blockchain to lower costs and replace antiquated clearing systems of increasingly opaque ledgers, as Ms. Long points out, but they still want to retain control over the value of the money itself, or at least what now passes for it, and what that money represents. They want to retain the system of perverse incentives that they've created, which rolls up the wealth of the world to them. And let's not forget, folks, blockchain not only gives them control, but the ability to track every single transaction in the blockchain as well. Which leads to Ms. Long's conclusion in her Forbes piece, where she says and believes that Facebook's cryptocurrency will turn out in the end to be a Trojan horse that actually benefits Bitcoin. As we witness a fundamental shift away from public-issued money as a trusted medium of exchange. Says Luongo, if folks like Martin Armstrong are correct when he wrote that we're approaching the end of a mega-cycle in public trust and a massive shift in consciousness to private assets as stores of wealth, well then again it makes sense for the powers that be to try to create a private, in name only, cryptocurrency to co-opt that shift and remain in control. But the trouble, he says, is that it also means those same people who fed at this trough for so long aren't any more capable of managing that successfully than they were the dollar and the euro. Well, here I pause and part company just a bit with Tom Luongo, folks. When it comes to success, they basically own who knows how many trillions worth of the world's assets at this point and control most of its governments. Isn't that at least success in the sense that they were up front looking for? And here's another, I would say, at least somewhat questionable argument. As Bloomberg points out, he says, whether Libra will be used in commerce is very much in question. For the last decade, multiple cryptocurrencies, starting with Bitcoin, have tried and failed, so far anyway, to penetrate coffee shops and retail stores. And in the first 4 months of this year, only 1.3% of Bitcoin's economic transactions, and they can track them all so they know, came from merchants, according to researcher Chain Analysis, Inc., while the rest was trading. Now here's where I have to throw in literally the devil's advocate argument. How many of those coffee shops and retail stores have Facebook pages, folks? And don't really care whether their information is private or not. Joseph Lubin, co-creator of the Ethereum blockchain coin, said the following, while Libra might be a big step in opening up a new wave of users to the benefits of asset-backed digital money, it comes with the risks of centralized pain points and vulnerabilities. Data silos enable incumbents to maintain pricing power and also come with the risk of, well, we knew this, right? Data breaches, privacy, and security issues, problems that many have already begun to associate with Facebook, unquote. And that's true. No doubt about it. Lots and lots and lots of problems with two Facebook. So I have to ask it as a question. Given what we've seen when it comes to the stupidity of so many of the masses today, and it's being cultivated and growing, and they're bringing more in every single day, not only to suck at that same public teat, but convert the United States into one of those third world countries that two Facebook is evidently targeting here, will sound money, honesty, integrity, old-fashioned concepts like privacy, free speech, and the rule of law win out in the long term over the Trojan horse? Or will a dumbed-down American populace simply go with what's easy, what they've already gotten used to, and what they're being pushed into anyway? But come on, you can't trust two Facebook with your data. Who would really want to give them their money, too? Yeah, I know. That speaks volumes as well.